Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Channel. Our topic today is the role of emerging and individualized therapy for non-small cell lung cancer. We'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program. We'd also like to thank Eli Lilly and Company for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. Physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoverychannelcme.com and taking the post-test. All the graphics and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post-test, and earn free credit for the program, so do it today. We're fortunate to have a distinguished group of experts in the studio with us today to talk about the use of emerging and individualized therapy for non-small cell lung cancer. Dr. Mark A. Sosinski, Professor of Medicine, Multidisciplinary Thoracic Oncology Program, Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Jyothi D. Patel, Associate Professor, Division of Hematology Oncology, Feinberg School of Medicine, Northwestern University, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Howard Jack West, Medical Director, Thoracic Oncology Program, Swedish Cancer Institute in Seattle. During the next hour, we plan to discuss the following: identification of basic histology of non-small cell lung cancer and explanations on how this influences therapeutic choices, selection of appropriate first-line chemotherapeutic regimens for non-small cell lung cancer, application of key chemotherapeutic clinical trial findings to manage patients who have failed first-line treatment, utilization of biomarkers for the selection of targeted therapies, and description of outcomes in minority groups and identification of the barriers which impede diagnosis and treatment. Doctors, let's start by reminding your colleagues of the prevalence of non-small cell lung cancer.
Lung cancer is extraordinarily common. We expect over 220,000 Americans to be diagnosed with it in 2010. It is the leading cause of cancer death in American men and women, and in fact accounts for more cancer deaths than breast, prostate, and colon cancer combined. Most patients with non-small cell lung cancer were smokers, but up to 15% of people have never smoked, and many, many other patients stopped smoking decades ago. The most common kind of lung cancer is non-small cell lung cancer, and accounts for almost 85% of cases.
So what are some of the most common risk factors for non-small cell lung cancer?
I think we all know of the relationship between smoking and developing this disease. There is a clear dose response effect, if you will. The more you smoke, the more likely you are to get it. Although we know that many patients who smoke their entire lives never get this disease. And so I think we struggle with the issues of susceptibility. We know this runs in families. It's important to know the family history of the patient. There are certain occupational exposures. We know that in patients who have received prior radiation therapy, young people who have radiation therapy for, say, Hodgkin's disease are at increased risk. There's an environmental exposure called radon that's implicated in the etiology of this disease. And as Dr. Patel mentioned, we see about 10% of our patients who have never smoked. So I think that there are issues in the never smoker population developing this disease that we're beginning to understand.
So how do patients with non-small cell lung cancer typically present? What are some of the signs and symptoms?
They're generally divided between those related to the disease in the chest and those that are more related to problems elsewhere in the body. Within the chest, it's most typical to have a persistent cough, non-exertional chest pain, shortness of breath, and some patients will cough up blood, which is certainly something that brings people to medical attention promptly. Otherwise, we often will have patients present with symptoms of more generalized systemic disease. That'll be ongoing fatigue, diminished appetite and weight loss, or potentially symptoms related to the spread of the disease to a particular place, pain in a bone, neurologic symptoms related to brain metastases, those kinds of issues.
What are the major types of non-small cell lung cancer tumors?
The most common type of non-small cell lung cancer is adenocarcinoma, and that histologic type is becoming more and more common. Secondly, we see squamous cell carcinomas. Those tumors tend to present with central tumors, and that was the most common histologic type for decades until adenocarcinoma became more prevalent. We see adenocarcinomas more often in women and people who haven't smoked. There is a third type of lung cancer, which is far less frequent, and that's large cell carcinoma. There is an overlap with undifferentiated carcinoma as well. It's important to point out that although we break this into nice histologic groups, often we'll see admixtures. So a patient may have a combination of adenocarcinoma and squamous carcinoma, and that can be a little bit difficult and tricky to deal with.
Sometimes, even with getting a good sample of the tissue, the cancer can be so poorly differentiated that even a good, attentive pathologist is not really able to assign a category to it, and we'll just call it poorly differentiated non-small cell lung cancer, not otherwise specified.
Fortunately, that's happening less and less. I think one of the areas where we've really changed our approach to diagnosis is to really do bigger biopsies, core biopsies or excisional biopsies of various sites, because I think histology is important. We need to give our pathologists more material so they can do their best job at interpreting the histology, because it's a relevant issue in our management of patients on a day-to-day basis.
How are these tumors staged?
We stage them initially by the extent of disease in the chest. How big is the primary tumor in the lung? Are there regional nodes involved? Principally in the mediastinum, and then systemic staging. The typical workup at our site is to do a PET scan with the brain MRI that pretty much surveys the entire body. We stage it stage 1, 2, 3, and 4, and the importance of that and the importance of accurate staging is that our treatment recommendations are going to be totally dependent upon stage.
It's also important that you see a multidisciplinary group of physicians. Certainly, for years, only surgeons did our pathologic staging with procedures such as mediastinoscopy. As we have more and more metabolic staging, it may be that we're able to identify suspicious lymph nodes and access them in other ways, such as endobronchial ultrasound or EGD with ultrasonography. This puts patients at decreased risk, but provides accurate information for us.
And just to put this in perspective, there was a study well known to us several years ago looking at a large database in the United States in lung cancer patients who underwent mediastinoscopy. And of those patients that had that surgical procedure, slightly less than half of them actually had a pathology report associated with that surgical procedure, which means that surgeons were evaluating the mediastinum, looking around, but not sampling appropriately and not sending it to the pathologist for documentation of that. And that I think, is a historic standard of care. I think the standard of care nowadays, whether it's before you go to the operating room or whether you're in the operating room, that dedicated staging of the regional lymph nodes is important.
Are there specific factors that determine the prognosis and the treatment method for non-small cell lung cancer?
Well, the most important aspect is certainly staging. So the size of the tumor, the number of lymph nodes, or if there is a presence of metastatic disease. And then certainly there are tumor characteristics in patients with earlier stage disease. Things like early blood vessel invasion may portend a likelihood of recurrence. Clinical factors, though, play an enormous role. Lung cancer occurs in patients who are often not young. The average age is 70. And so patients with comorbid conditions may end up with worse prognosis simply because of their other medical problems. And we really have to keep that in mind as we individualize therapy, particularly in patients with metastatic disease.
We have known that patients who have more poorly differentiated tumors also tend to have a worse prognosis because the cancer progresses more quickly. At the same time, there are features within our staging system now, such as a refinement of the size of the primary tumor for early stage disease, that makes sense in that we know that patients who have a 7-centimeter tumor tend to have a worse prognosis than those with a 3 or 4-centimeter tumor. And with our new staging system that just came out this past year, there is a distinction within the framework of metastatic disease that distinguishes patients with chest-only involvement and those who have metastatic disease outside of the chest, the latter having a little worse prognosis than those where, even though it's metastatic, it's all confined to the chest.
Let's move on to the chemotherapeutic options. What are the typical first-line therapies?
For the majority of patients, the cornerstone is a 2-drug chemotherapy combination a doublet, and particularly a platinum-based doublet combination. The historical older standard was cisplatin, and that's still used and can be appropriate for some patients, but it does have some toxicity challenges with it, and commonly what is used in the U.S. is carboplatin, a related drug that tends to have a more favorable toxicity profile that is particularly important in a setting in which we unfortunately aren't able to cure patients and want to definitely prioritize tolerability as well. The combinations are usually a platinum drug with one of the newer agents that have come out in the last 10 or 15 years. These can include the taxanes, paclitaxel or docetaxel, gemcitabine, vinorelbine, and pemetrexed. And what's been particularly interesting to see is that in some cases there could be relevant differences in their efficacy based on the particular non-small cell histology.
One of the efforts that we've done is to try to add targeted agents to this chemotherapy backbone. So the most commonly used chemotherapy backbone in the United States for years was a combination of carboplatin and paclitaxel. There was a trial in which a monoclonal antibody, bevacizumab, was added to these drugs, and it showed that there was a significant improvement in survival in patients who received all three drugs. Now, the trial was actually in a restricted patient population, and that was because patients in the phase 2 experience who had squamous cell histology had an increased risk of fatal or life-threatening pulmonary hemorrhage. It wasn't that the drug wasn't effective, it was that the drug carried with it untoward risk. And so for patients who have non-squamous histology, often the sort of grade one evidence that we have or the best therapeutic option could be a combination of carboplatin, paclitaxel with bevacizumab.
There are a number of possibilities with regard to platinum-based doublets. And it wasn't until recently when we had this relatively new agent, pemetrexed. There was a large study done comparing cisplatinum gemcitabine to cisplatinum pemetrexed in all histologies, but there was a pre-specified analysis of that trial based upon histology. And what it suggested or revealed, actually, was that the combination of a platinum plus pemetrexed led to superior survival outcomes compared to cisplatinum gemcitabine in the non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, where when you looked at the squamous histology patients, the cisplatinum pemetrexed arm actually was inferior to the cisplatinum gemcitabine arm. So this was the first convincing example from a large phase 3 trial, in fact the largest ever done, that histology matters with regard to the selection of your first-line chemotherapy choice.
What is the efficacy of these treatment choices for non-small cell lung cancer?
The median survival times tend to range, depending upon which population you study, kind of the 8 to 12 months in that range, and there's some variance there. We expect one-year survivals to be in the range of 30 to 40% in general, but up to 50% in selected populations. And again, in some selected populations, we expect somewhere between 20 to 25% of patients to be alive 2+ years after their diagnosis. So those are the data from large randomized phase 3 clinical trials. And we know that in these populations, there's a great deal of heterogeneity in terms of how patients tolerate, how patients respond to therapies. And we like to think that we're getting better at individualizing our therapies based upon the characteristics of the patients.
In terms of response rates, I think that about a third of patients have some decrease in their tumor burden, about a third of patients have stability of disease, and a third of patients have disease that grows despite chemotherapy with the initial treatment. That means two-thirds of people are benefiting. And even those patients with stable disease do have improvement in their quality of life and often in their lung cancer symptoms. So they may experience less dyspnea, their weight loss may be curtailed, and they fare better than others. So when I meet a patient and discuss chemotherapy, I'll say that statistically you should have some response. We usually, after two cycles, reevaluate the tumor to see whether they are. And if they are, we proceed generally with between 4 and 6 cycles of chemotherapy, and it's either 2 drugs, as Dr. Zasinski said, or 3 with the addition of a targeted agent. We know that treatment beyond that is probably not helping the patient because there are quality of life issues, the patients often have cumulative toxicity. But initial treatment, we expect the majority of patients to have some benefit from.
Our therapies do improve survival, and this was something that was debated and unfortunately is still a prevalent question outside of the oncology field, where some patients are not being referred to an oncologist because there are unfortunately still some people who are gatekeepers before they can see us, who may have outdated ideas of the side effects of our treatment, which are oftentimes much less toxic than they used to be, and may underestimate the benefit. While it is no longer a question that the median overall survival improves by several months for a broad population, an equally compelling issue is that we have far more patients than we used to have just a few years ago who are now living several years. That is no longer a rare occasion. We see more and more patients living 2, 3, sometimes 5 or more years than we ever saw before, and this provides a lot more hope.